SCP-8217, Trauma to Phobia, Better Them Than Us. Humans, in general, toil through their lives not specifically in pursuit of pleasure, but rather in the relief of pain and discomfort. Only a very small percentage of the average person's life would be described as pleasurable, while most of it could be described as being either in discontent or content. The capacity for pain and suffering in the human mind far outweighs its capacity for pleasure, and thus most people do whatever they can to avoid it. Traumatophobia is the irrational fear of being injured or suffering a traumatic event, and like many phobias, stems from a fear that many people have. SCP-8217 is about pain, suffering, death, the ability to inflict it, and perhaps the ability to endure it. Let's take a look. The article begins with a message conversation between Site-592 director Russ Braithwaite and O57. Braithwaite says that they really have to talk, as this isn't a breach, although it's arguably an invasion from a single alien organism. But either way, it's from something they never had contained. He knows the distinction is immaterial in practice, but he knows the breach desk, as their first, second, and third questions are about what destructive or disruptive actions, if any, are being undertaken by the breaching anomaly. That's not a methodology that would work in this instance, as it's an airship, and it's just sitting there. He knows he sounds crazy, but he's sending over the 8217 file, which should shed a bit more light. Once 057 is finished, or as soon as she's convinced of need, he'll request substantial external assistance, ideally an MTF. He tells 057 not to scramble anyone without some form of filtering, and 057 understands, as she knows 8217. They've never encountered an airship before, but the arrival of one is certainly a tail risk they've planned for. Braithwaite will get the support he needs. Braithwaite deeply appreciates it and says that they have 300 employees here, with at least 80 already infected. They may need to amnesticize everyone here several times before this is over. With that, we're given the file for 8217, a set of 22 fingers that appeared on the desk of a Site-48 researcher on June 8, 2024. Testing has confirmed that all of the fingers come from a single humanoid entity of an as-yet-unidentified species, each measuring between 5 and 8 centimeters, and all having been violently severed. When touched, each of them induces a distinct vision of life upon an alien planet. Within the vision, all intelligent life forms are perceived as human, although the actual appearance of these life forms, if extant, is unknown. A minority of these visions cause exposed individuals to develop an as-yet poorly understood disorder, characterized by heightened aggression and increased comfort with the concept of human extinction. To avoid this, infectious visions are auto-censored by an AIC. Using the relative size of astronomical phenomena perceivable in the background of the visions, Foundation astronomers successfully triangulated the depicted planet and obtained an image of it through the extrasolar observational array. From orbit, the surface of the planet appears of uniform color and without geographic variation, bearing little resemblance to the lush planet observed in the visions. Ongoing explosions are visible at several points across its surface. It's orbited by two moons, and their orbital speeds imply that the density of the planet is comparable to that of animal biomass. We're then given a partial record of some of the visions, starting with the first finger. You are Hanu Kalal, scarcely king. You are tired, bone tired. You see yourself in the gilded pain that surrounds the hemicycle. Your green robes have been scuffed by hard riding. No crown covers your pate. Against the advice of your aide, you let your eyes drift upward. Dozens of kings are gathered, and none of their faces are kind. A few second sons sit in the crowd, gold-threaded cloth tied over their vacant sockets. You wonder which ones slew their kin. You wonder how they did it. The steward turns to you. He is a slight man, trusted by all, above reproach, beneath contempt. You nod at him. He nods back and turns his face to the crowd. He begs their patience and states that he yields ground to the dispossessed. You take the podium. Gratitude. Gratitude to this assembly of kings. Gratitude to the Royal Federation. Gratitude to the Font of Song. Long I have ridden. Long have I feared this day. My hold on Kalalia was broken by my child, and I was banished from my land, from my own rightful domain. He took my diadem from my head. He set me on this cruel journey. He has shown none of the filial respect to which I am entitled. A voice rings out from above and says that your hardship is yours to bear. Begging your patience, you say, and sigh. I've come to sing my lands away. Another voice from above speaks, King Kerrigan, who offers 20% of its loot, causing King Curran to erupt into laughter. Curran asks why he makes such a beggar's offer, to which Kerrigan explains that Kalalia is not a wealthy land, and the diadem of its royal family has certain powers that could render it difficult to defeat. He doesn't like the idea of fighting 10,000 clones for a molehill of gold. Permission to elaborate on the diadem, you ask, and Kerrigan says, please. The holder of the diadem has a few powers, most of the standard form associated with a low-level magical artifact. Teleporting small objects, conveying memory with a touch, nothing with which your majesties are unfamiliar. Kerrigan states that those are plainly not the powers that he references. Yes, its sole major property, to which King Kerrigan refers, is the ability for the holder of the diadem to duplicate himself. But there are numerous limitations to this ability, which impair its usefulness in war. Duplicates cannot maneuver independently. The holder can move all of them at once, or one at a time, but the holder cannot make one shoot and another walk. An army of such duplicates could never ford a river, or take any other action that requires multiple persons to undertake different, though simultaneous, movements. What is more, the holder feels the pain of each duplicate, and must eat copiously, to the point of distending his stomach, to enable the duplication process to occur. Duplicates are typically used solely to impair assassination attempts. There is little chance that your majesties would face an army of them. Kerrigan asks why you reveal this, and you say, to assure you of the soundness of your investment. I wore the diadem for many years. I know its limits as I know my own heart. Kerrigan is not convinced, but Curran is, and offers 60%. The chamber is silent. You too are silent. It is the largest loot share ever offered in the chamber. How Curran plans to profit off his conquest, none can say. A generous offer. Gratitude. Gratitude. Are there any beneficial standards of trade that you would request upon my restoration? King Curran laughs again. King, when my armies have passed through your land, there will be nothing to trade, no one to trade with, and no throne to restore you to. But you will have no need for those persons. Your wealth will be vast as the sun. You see your grin in the gilded pane. Next is the vision from the third finger. You are King Kerrigan, wealthy, cautious. Your retainers sit 80 feet away, on the far side of the hemicycle. When the meeting ends, not more than an hour hence, you will be reunited with them. They are collating Von Mott's. They know your mood is foul. You are with them so often that you think of them, at points, as part of yourself. They are the part of your brain that soothes anger, that does those things that you did when you were still an heir. Royalty is a second childhood. You know that Curhin is also a child. 60%, you whisper. You've got no chance of making a sesterce. Curhin replies that he's not after profit. Then you're after the diadem. Curhin says that he'll give that back to Hanu once he's slain all of his kin. If he wants a new family, he can make one as large as he wants, out of the only member of it he's ever cared for. Amusement, then. Curhin says that that is part of it, but largely because his advisor has developed a weapon of unparalleled force. It strikes like a dream, he's told. Explosions so vast that they make new threnodies in the song. It floats far above the earth, where none can touch it. And the simple act of seeing it drives men to frantic, animal courage. They have built 100 at his direction, and he has not himself seen it in person yet, but the testing shows that they stand on the brink of a new world. This strikes me as a state secret. Curhin replies that it was, and he tells him now because it's too late to avert it. Surely such force is not necessary to defeat the Kalals. Curhin just wants to make everyone witness their might. It'll make looting easier, it'll accelerate future surrenders, and should the time come to fix certain discrepancies between their historic borders. But says to never mind about that. He wants to shock the world and unnerve it. You've certainly unnerved me. Curhin says that that's a promising start, but no. He doesn't care about Kalalia. That's why all of it will burn. Next is the vision from the fourth finger. You are Rosu Kalal, lately king, helmsman of 16 eyes in 8 heads. One of them is immured, a spare in the case of disaster. Your designated survivor, it sees only the clean and cushioned walls of the room of its imprisonment. The other 7 are in the throne room. 6 recline in the shadows of the hall, unmoving, and the 7th, recipient of your current attentions, sits the throne. When you claimed it, the weight of the diadem sat easy on your head. You wondered, why not sooner? Now you only wonder why you let your father live. At your left hand sits your dour general. At your right hand sits your younger brother, Eyeless Se, bandage about his face, his aide cradled behind him. Your ministers have left the room, frightened in ways that frightened you. Ansem, the Lord of Fisheries, wouldn't meet your gaze. He left in a hurry, not more than 20 minutes before. You're sure he's on a fast horse to the hinterlands. You think of replacing him. You wonder why you'd bother. He'd be back soon enough, with Hanu. You know these Royal Federation deals. A targeted invasion, a rapid surrender, punishing taxes to pay off the conqueror, and then a gradual return to normalcy. Your father backed an invasion once, and it paid off for him handsomely. You wonder if you yourself should take flight. Any word from the spies within Curhinia, you ask? The general says, unfortunately, yes, with one saying that the damage Curhin intends to exact is going to be unusually severe for a Royal Federation intervention. Do we know what he means by that? The general replies that it might be wise to take Curhin seriously, but not always literally. It seems that he's been tromping around his palace, declaring that he wants to see their whole land burned. Can we negotiate with him? I'm not too proud to teleport a missive into his court. The general states that he took the liberty of reaching out already, without your consent. He isn't open to negotiation, and seems eager to exhibit his new weapon, his airship. Perhaps we seed a town or two for his exhibition. The general replies that he will reach out, but he is not optimistic. What do we know about this airship? The general explains that it is rigid, floating cartilage, like a whale in the sky, and it drops explosive material. It births it like an egg, and it is assuredly magical. They successfully placed a spy on the assembly line, but they haven't heard anything useful. They've received 70 messages, but all are gibberish. One saying that our world has built its own child. Another saying, what is your blood fated for? Another, that the new man flies. Is someone playing a joke on us? The general doesn't think so, but says that to our body of knowledge about the airship, they must add that those who see it become sick. Back in the present, Braithwaite tells 057 that the situation has evolved. Images of the airship are capable of spreading it, and they sent it around. Some were amnesticizable, others weren't. They've lost 12 people outright, maybe more, and there's another 60 infected they've got barricaded away in the southeast corner of the main building. Some of them escaped into the cells, and if they're lucky, they're dead. The O5 asks how long ago that was, but Braithwaite says that he's not sure, as he doesn't remember it. He's told that he's popped his phone open and an aide tackled him. Now the aide is dead, apparently, most likely by Braithwaite's hand, as he woke up covered in blood. Also, all of this is permanent, and he knows it. It's like the noise in his head started screaming. The O5 asks if there's anyone she can speak to who wasn't infected or amnesticized, but Braithwaite says that she won't be getting rid of him so easy. 057 replies that they've worked together for years, and he's just paranoid. She can assure him that nobody's going to hold him responsible for actions undertaken while under the influence of a cognitohazard. She's sure that Braithwaite has been on the other side of the desk, telling someone else that nobody blames them for whatever they did when something else was riding their mind. She just needs access to someone with a memory of the actual breach to get a sense of what he needs. Braithwaite replies that he'll ask around later, but for now, send an MTF on top of the current team. We're then given the vision from the seventh finger, although this one is noted as being infectious and has a couple of bits redacted. You are marching through the plains. When you arrived, they were all watching. It gave you a thrill to see so many eyes upon you. Such fear, such work to be done. Then, one by one, they looked up at the mass above you. You saw their knees weaken, grins spread across their faces, an understanding of their fate, an eagerness for it. When they fought, it was not out of hope, but for love of it. Rabid, but vastly outmatched. A pleasure to slay. You look forward to your own end, but there are so many joys that lurk before it. You and your brethren took their corpses out to the front gate and set them aflame. Then, from a far distance, the airship laid its egg upon the village's remains. So disproportionate. A ruin far exceeding the village it replaced. You looked, and love bloomed in your heart. The love of a father for a child that has far surpassed him. And then you kept marching. To clean your weapons seems so shameful. You wish all the blood stayed upon it. You wish that you could look at it and see all at once the fruit of your efforts. You wear the robes of Kerhinia, purple and red, but Kerhin's not who you march for. You march for your boy. He's so sharp, so lovely. You'll give him the world. We're then given an excerpt of written material taken from the background of a vision from the fifth finger, which reads, "And the Admiral dreams too, of a great new airship, vast as loathing, slow as continents, sure than sunrise, steady as time, unloading its fire on a land so scarred that none of it makes any difference. It calls to him as whale song echoes in the deep, in the places things lie before they are real. And he knows, when he dies, that he'll ride that great ship till it clears past the land and leaves it behind, and then goes on sailing, surer than sunrise, metronome steady, until he forgets any end to the sky." 057 tells Braithwaite that she pulled up the last few minutes of the log, and she can confirm that, at minimum, one co-pilot was not wearing a filter on the ride in. There's going to be an investigation, and all she can tell him is that the second team has been apprised and is 40 minutes out. Braithwaite says that the crash took out part of the southeastern building, and some infected escaped into the northeastern. Someone didn't barricade one of the exterior doors properly, and now, as best as he can tell, another four people are dead. He lost the other two spec units, and there might be a few infected still wandering the desert. The O5 asks about personnel losses among the infected, but Braithwaite isn't sure, although they're certainly making a lot of noise. They still have access to life signs tracking, so they know at least six humanoid anomalies in the containment cells are dead. They also made a mural on the windows, an attempted contaminant of a depiction of an airship, but it's not very good. It's made out of what she thinks it's made out of. Next is the vision from the 10th finger, also infectious and with a small amount redacted. A few fires over, a detachment of Kerhinian soldiers has begun stabbing each other. No officers now in the morass. Only the airships and the masses that birthed them. No resistance sufficient to justify the peace that characterizes order. No need for so many soldiers to finish this land. For some, for the lucky, there's no need to delay the ecstasy of death. Halfway across the fire, a man begins speaking. "If you went up in space, you'd just see the buildings and roads. That's not our footprint. That's what we are. We're barely humans. We're the tadpoles. They're the frogs. We are the fetal intermediate forms, the chrysalises, and true life is them, inanimate. And we finally built one able to stand on its own." He pauses. He stares at the fire with holy intensity. "We thought we were people. We're not. We're the chaff. And soon our child won't need us." You don't know why he says all this. You know all this. You learned it the moment you first saw its beauty above you. Then it hits you. He's trying to bore your camp to anger. He wants to be killed. You stand up. "You selfish shit," you say. "It's not your turn." He grins. He grabs his weapon. The others around the fire cheer. They're jealous of you. They wish they had thought to get up first, to steal the moment, to have the chance to fight. But you're of two minds about it. You have no desire to give him what he wants. You don't. The next day, the camp departs. He is left on the empty plain, crying out for water, abdomen opened skyward. A stray airship will end him, eventually. Or thirst, or infection. You smile to think of it. He should have been more patient. We're then given some more written material found in the background of the vision from the sixth finger. which reads, "Better void than loss. Better steel than flesh. Better cold than heat. Better the fire than what it replaces. Better silence than song. Better death than stagnation. Better them than us." Next is the vision from the 14th finger. You are King Curhin at your war minister's door. He says that he can talk you through some new weapon ideas. What would be the point? He grins and says that you're right. I was wondering if there were any earlier prototypes of the airship before you settled on the current design. The war minister, however, says that there were never prototypes. You mean the initial design of the airship was its current form? He explains, however, that he never designed it, but rather found the first one in the desert 2 years ago. The pilot seat had the bones of an animal he'd never seen, petrified and many millennia dead. It came from a different world, he thinks, one that manufactured them for a use of their own. Why didn't you tell me this? He states that you would have never understood until you saw it. So why did it come here? The minister says that you're already learning, as you didn't ask why the animal drove it here, but rather why it came. Answer. He states that it came here because it wanted to reproduce. But what triggered it? None of our airships have decamped for the stars. Not yet, but they will, he says. This too is part of it. Vestigial organs decay. The caterpillar is swallowed in the metamorphosis. It is the fate of children to bury their parents. The airships target intelligent life, and though they are starting with Kalalians, they will not end until we are scoured from this earth. Only then will they turn toward the stars. The minister took a sip from his own cup and continues. The illness, the rage, is like a signal that causes a cell to die. It's meant to help us yield to them, to these playful beasts for which the world was made. You stare at your minister in wonderment. After a moment, three words escape your lips. That's so beautiful. The 16th vision is short and simple. You are a traveler. You are hungry. You see the lights of distant villages in the fog. You know that there used to be more of them. Then we have the 19th vision. You are Se. You see nothing. The bodies of your brother pace up and down the cave. The air is stuffy but cold. So much stone is above you. You nearly feel its weight. Rosu, speaking from several mouths, states that the food is late, by 1 hour. Oh, maybe it's coming. He replies that it's not about the food. He is first priority on distribution. If there's any interruption in food provision, then that means that they have no idea what's going on up there. Don't you have a spare up there to check the situation out? He replies that this is his spare, and he's talking to his spares. Are you worried about the food? He is, slightly, should it worsen. You are careful, precise with your words. You can convert anything into biomass when eating it, in order to duplicate yourself. He replies that that's true, but that doesn't give him nutrients, and it wouldn't do anything for you. No, but it does mean that, even down here, you can create an indefinite number of duplicates, mute and barely conscious. Rosu pauses and says that he'd feel all their pain. Yes, you'd want to kill them before you eat them. Rosu finds it to be utterly repulsive, and says that he fails to see it as obviously preferable to death. If you don't want to, you can hand me the diadem, and I will. Rosu is dumbfounded, before thanking you in a soft and weak voice. He says that he doesn't want to, but he'll bear it in mind. You don't say anything. What would you say? It's quiet for some time. Hard to say how long. A soft breeze starts halfway down the cavern and rustles your toes. You hear him weeping. Only one of him. The others are mute. You reach out your hand and let him take it. In the present, Braithwaite messages 057 about the MTF she said was coming. The 05 replies that sending an external security team is common practice for rapid amnesticization of unarmed persons, and asks what issue he has with the team he received. Braithwaite replies that he can see one of their arms outside of the window. He knows folks on the other side of the barricade, and the walls aren't soundproofed. He knows enough of what's going on. The 05 states that the MTF is en route, and Braithwaite says that he has that photo on his phone still, and if he doesn't get backup in 50 minutes, he's sending it across the site director's network. 057 says that they're trying their best here, and sending that across the network would doom thousands at least, billions at worst. It would, among many other things, irreparably destroy his legacy. Braithwaite just says that she doesn't seem to think there's sufficient urgency here, and the 05 adds that the Foundation is more than willing to subject individuals and associates thereof to customized punishment regimes for novel infringements of the Foundation's disciplinary code. Braithwaite just tells her that he wouldn't be spending much time on threats if he was her, as she doesn't have that much time. Next is the 20th vision, also logged as infectious. You had a name once, but all those who called you it are gone. You pass the lip of another smoking blotch of plain, on all fours, face inches off the ground. Dust and ash invade the streaks of sloughed-off skin. Yesterday you were caught on the edge of a bombing. You were the lucky one. Your red, raw arms go up and over, up and over. Your sweat drops fall with flakes within them. If this used to be the town you think it was, then you can't be more than 5 miles from the riverside. Fresh water ran there. That can't have ceased. Wind blows. A minute's coolness, though it scrapes at your burned back. You sit up, forcing a fluid motion. The pain hits all at once, and you cry out. You smell rotting flesh on the wind. Before you, something is head-on. The contempt whispers off of it. You know at once that you are not worth hatred. You wonder who has had this chance to hear the song, to see the lips from which it issues, to know that you are among the last to hear it because of how soon the issuer will end it. You are thankful to it for showing you this truth. Its payload crushes you. You are gone before the explosion, smeared on the vacant plain, former leaseholder ushered out of the homestead. No, the world was never yours at all. Then we have the 21st vision. You are Se, so many empty sockets. You felt him stab your heart. You felt him stab your heart. You felt him stab your heart. Unsure how long you've been down there. How many measures have passed in the song. The distant sound of blasts, occasional, above you. You eat the flesh of your own haunch. His bodies stir at random around the chamber. Your bodies, too. Slow and fitful steps. It's been so long since the two of you have spoken. It probably helps him to forget you're alive. Before he could walk, before you could speak, you lost your eyes to him. He didn't mean to take them. Common practice. Meant to avoid potential bumps in the succession. You wipe your meat from your lips. Uniform. Universal. And what's the rest of your body, too? No room for spite. No point in it, here at the end of the world. He sits beside you. We're the last ones left, he says. We have to be. We've been down here for over a year now. He's been counting our sleeps. There's no word from above. So what if we are? He states that the airships are made to kill everyone living, and just seeing them makes people long to kill and die for them. If we're the last ones, then the planet is dead, and they're just waiting for us to die to escape to the stars. There must be others, in bunkers this deep. He says maybe, but there can't be many. We might be the last trace of life in the world. Then we should wait down here for as long as we can, no? Rosu calls it cowardice, but you disagree. No. No. When we die, they... The first airship came from somewhere. You heard it. Our own spies said it. Our own generals confirmed it. The airship emptied the world it was manufactured on. Then it journeyed out into space and found Kurhin. Once we die, the airships will go out into space. There's thousands of them now. They'll find other planets. But if we can stay alive, then the two of us can keep all of them locked up here. Rosu argues that it's only a matter of time, and within 5 years, or maybe 10, by sheer chance they'll bring down a bomb right over our heads. 2-3 direct hits is all it would take to dislodge us, and we're running out the clock, no matter what. Then we should do all we can. Rosu doesn't know if he's strong enough to just sit here waiting for death. One day, then another day. And don't forget, I'm here too. He asks if it was his fault, but you say no. He says that it wouldn't have happened if he hadn't, but you cut him off. It wouldn't have started in Kalalia, but it would have come here. Kurhin wanted to use his airships. He would have used them on someone. Someone would come to sing their lands away. Rosu laments that he misses the world. And you do too. I miss how it smelled when it rained. He sighs and says that he misses how it felt to ride, the wind on his face, the warmth on his skin. He could start a long list of the things he misses. There is time. He laughs and says that he would do horrible things for some cake. That's believable. We're currently doing horrible things for food that tastes much worse. Rosu then leans forward and says that he's going to kill himself. Maybe not today, but soon. You don't say anything. He grabs your hand. He's wearing the diadem. His memories flow into you as soon as he touches you. Things he doesn't want lost. I know it's not honorable, he says, but I really can't take it. Eyes. Body. What's the rest of your life? I understand, you say, into the dark. He says that he loves you, and you say it back. Too late for prayer. Still, it's a few hours before the last of them go quiet. Elsewhere, distant airships lay their eggs. You fumble on the ground. You climb over the corpses of your brother, the corpses of yourself, some half-eaten. Some still warm. You come upon the knife. You pick it up. You put it down. He really couldn't take it. But you can take it. You come upon the diadem and place it on your head. You scrape clay and dust from the cave and thrust it in your mouth, over and over, filling yourself up. And when your stomach is swollen and distended, you divide. Two bodies, both of them hungry, both of them scraping the wall, both of them filling up, splitting, each. You're in no hurry. There's plenty of material. And by the time you surface, you'll be too numerous to bomb. You are eating with 16, 32 mouths. In the present, 057 messages Braithwaite to tell him that the MTF is 10 minutes out. Braithwaite is happy to hear that, but he has some good news. They were able to get out of the courtyard and supply amnestics to a number of surviving personnel. Unfortunately, a lot of losses on their side, but they managed to mostly depopulate themselves on the other side of the divide well in advance, so it was a faster takeover than they'd feared. They've reestablished control of the northwestern building fully. It also looks like all or almost all of the infected relocated there, so they've been able to meet up with survivors of the northeastern building. The worst is fully over, and if she'd be amenable, she can feel free to scuttle the MTF. They really just need aviation specialists. 057 asks why, and Braithwaite says that that's a fair question, and he'll upload a relevant picture. He then says that she has a cognitohazard filter, calling it charming, and notes that she's had him locked out of the network. That's fine, as there are fail-safes. Site communication is very, very important and can't be taken down so easy. That's why they're talking, isn't it? The truth is that they probably don't even need aviation specialists, as they can figure it out themselves. He's glad she's not infected, as he can't wait to see fear on her smug face, and can't wait to watch the pain come. 057 logs onto a terminal and cuts off Site 592 from the Site 01 secure line, but a partially drafted message from Braithwaite is still sent. It says that she flew up when she joined, and he's nodded and smiled, but there's been something in him that's wanted to show her who she is. There won't be much time before they all go, but there'll be time enough to exhibit everything he can imagine upon her like a fruit, just there to be consumed before the last bloody sunset. He will leave her howling and screaming, and so far below him that she will lick his shoes and cry out for mercy. 057 then detonates the Site 592 on-site warhead. We're then given the last vision from the 22nd finger. You are Se. Se is below and above and before you, pressed down hard, sweaty back on sweaty back, and your ribs are fire, and the air around you burns. You are muttering, a soft whisper into a small crevice not occupied by flesh. You say, they float above the surface 600 meters. And to build to that peak, given a surface area of 464 trillion square meters, needs 280.2 quadrillion cubic meters. Explosions come frequent as heartbeats, and bring with them white-hot, seizing pain, doubled and redoubled. Nothing you could dream of, nothing you could know. 3,000 airships, each 30 minutes each, drops a bomb of 42 cubic meters, meaning each year that is 2.25 trillion cubic meters. You pause to bite your fingers off. They might not be yours. You feel it all the same. 123,750 years. Then I can eat the airships. Then I can die. You hope life blooms fast on your great corpse. With your mouth and some shoving, you deposit your fingers in your deplumed palms. Unsure where life is, or if there is life, send to each planet in case there is life. They came from somewhere. They're going elsewhere. Somewhere, upon one of your heads, the diadem awakens. The fingers, full of the memories of the world you ate, are fluttered away to their destination. Scent is fetid, acrid, rotting self and human shit. You feel yourself trillion-fold, being devoured, swallowing excrement. Even the screams are pain. No pause to your agony. You cannot take it. But it bites and tears and goes and goes and goes. Unconsciousness comes, a blessed instant. Then you wake up screaming elsewhere. You are the song and the pain of the song. Lastly, 057 messages 051 and says that she sent over all the documentation for the Site-592 detonation in line with internal reporting requirements. He knows that she's not especially trigger-happy, but she's still submitting voluntarily to a post-mortem investigation to ensure best practice was followed. He replies that he, for one, trusts her judgment, but he'll look this over himself and convene a commission after the weekly meeting. It's her turn to chair ad hoc investigations, but presuming her recusal, he'll send this on to 08. He says that it's a pretty tough break, though, but she says, better them than us. Alright, there's a few things going on here, but it all revolves around these airships. The airships are a species all on their own, although they do need to be piloted by a different species for some reason. Upon seeing one, it drives the viewer towards violence, seeking to cause extinction of their own kind. According to the author, this effect causes the viewer to carry out violence in the way that they best know how. So for most, this is a homicidal rage, but for others, such as the king or the war minister, it just makes them better at their jobs. The ships travel across the stars to wipe out intelligent life on every planet they come across, reproducing and spreading some more. They are among the most dangerous cognitohazards the Foundation has come across, which makes it a pretty bad day when one just crashes into the desert near a site. There's also the Fingers, which came from a planet that the ships had already visited. We learn that the Fingers belong to a blind individual named Se, who utilized a magical diadem to clone himself by consuming dirt and earth. He did this in order to stall the ships from leaving, as they'll only leave the planet once all intelligent life is wiped out, so he's been consuming earth and himself for countless years in order to continue cloning himself, feeling the pain of everything as the ships continue to drop bombs. The Foundation's inspection of the planet in the present day shows that the bombing is still going on, and the planet's density is comparable to that of animal biomass, suggesting that the entire planet has been replaced with Se's clones, but he's still holding on. In order to warn other planets of the danger of these ships, he has sent some of his Fingers bearing his memories, using some of the other powers of the diadem. Unfortunately, not all of the memories in the Fingers are his own, so some of them bear infectious images of the ships. Also, unfortunately, these ships are in multiple places at once, and it only takes one to likely doom most planets. Braithwaite at Site-592 was responsible for handling the appearance of one of the ships on Earth, and he did an admirable job for quite a while, but eventually he also succumbed and tried to spread it to the O5s. Cognitohazard filters blocked any image he tried to send, and 057 proceeded to cut the site off and detonate the nuke held there, seemingly solving the problem. There's no real indicator that any of the O5s are infected, but 057 does note that she's not usually trigger-happy, and does end by saying, better them than us. Perhaps it's just a truthful, if cold, statement from an O5. Or perhaps not. I won't try and end this one on some sort of philosophical note about the nature of man's inhumanity towards man, or say that most of human existence has been progressing us towards our own extinction. Instead, I'll just say that if most of us were more like Se, perhaps the world would be a better place.